get things rolling. It's great to see everyone for this final panel of the day, with two speakers that I promise will not disappoint as they provide us with an update on our strategic nuclear triad. I'm Jeff Prater, as Nancy said, the co-founder of the ANWA Deterrence Center, here with my Deterrence Center co-founder, David Carrington, who will moderate the Q&A portion of today's forum. So United States strategic nuclear deterrent is the foundation upon which we build our national security posture. It is what has prevented another world war. But this U.S. security bedrock is only as good as the credibility and effectiveness of each piece of the triad, from the capability to manufacture the warheads and the NSA to each leg of the triad, to nuclear command and control and communications. Our peer adversaries, China and Russia, have modernized and has been well reported in the process of expanding their capabilities. U.S. Senator Deb Fischer told us just yesterday here that Stratcom had briefed her on the fact that China has now more ICBM launchers than the United States. Russia has over 280 stationary and mobile launchers. And do the simple math, that's well more than the 405 silos we have and support our allies in NATO and in Asia. This is not the time for the United States to falter. Our five pillars of deterrence must stand strong and therefore must be modernized to sustain the credibility of our strategic deterrent for us and our global allies. So today we'll hear from the Navy and the Air Force on the state of modernization of the triad. Rear Admiral Scott Capano is the Program Executive Officer for the Navy's Columbia-class submarine. His previous flag assignments include Commander, Naval Undersea Warfare Center, and Director of the Comprehensive Test Facility and Program Executive Officer of Columbia. The Admiral has been a regular speaker at our Deterrence Center forums, covering the sea-based leg of the triad, critical workforce issues, and welcome back again. Brigadier General Ty Newman serves as the Director, Concepts and Strategy, and Deputy Chief Staff for Air Force Futures at the Pentagon. He served at the NSC and White House, at NNSA and Stratcom. General, we would like to have both of you here, and I'll now turn it over to Admiral Pano for his opening remarks.
Thanks, Jeff. I might be off my game a little bit too because I'm a recovering Eagles fan as well. So, I'll try to give you the best I can today, but understand where my head has been the last couple of days. So, I think it's great, obviously, for us to be invited to these forums to talk about the modernization of the triad. From I'm a submariner by trade, a Navy guy by trade, but certainly I understand the need for all legs of the triad, right? They all bring their respective, capabilities and advantages to bear. And so I won't talk about all those, but I'll kind of focus a little bit in on the high level on the sea-based leg of the deterrent. Right? What does that bring to the table? That's 70% of the accountable inventory. That's the survivability and assured second strike capability. So that really is, those are the hallmarks of the sea-based strategic deterrent. And as I'm sure everybody in this room knows, the last time we modernized that was development of the Ohio class that currently is controlling the sea today, and will do so into the late 30s. That class will remain around. But in parallel with keeping the Ohio going right now, the other part of my portfolio is obviously the Columbia class submarine and the modernization of the Ohio class. If I look at the Ohio class, that was a great, great submarine, well designed. We originally designed that submarine for about a 30-year service life. We were able to extend the class with some engineering analysis to a 42-year service life across the class. And now we find ourselves, hey, that's a long way for somebody to go. We haven't had many or any go that far, but we're confident we can get there based on the work that we're doing right now and how that class continues to perform, including how we evaluate how the SSGNs that we converted from Ohio class SSBNs to SSGNs, our ability of modern low ships that are operating more vigorously than the SSBN class. Use that as a hallmark. I'd use the term canaries in the coal mine to make sure to give us the confidence, and we have that confidence that the Ohio class will deliver on that service life extension that we needed to do. However, as we made decisions back in 2013 during the sequestration years, You know, the Navy had planned to start the modernization of the sea-based leg with the Columbia class starting in FY19. Back in 2013, we made some decisions, right, that based on sequestration, to push that start out from 19 to 21. Right? And we did a bunch of things that really gave us confidence that we could do that. You know, much more land-based prototyping on both propulsion and weapon systems. You know, a lot of earlier advanced construction and advanced procurement to support the class. So things that would help buy down the risk of delaying the start 2 years for that class. And we have benefited from all those things very, very well. So that's where we are today. In FY21, we started full rate construction on the lead ship of the Columbia class. That is formally named the District of Columbia. We did the formal keeling for that vessel and Electric Boat back in June of last year, so we are well on our way with that class. The class in general will be, you know, the biggest submarine we've ever built, the quietest submarine we've ever built, and just so we understand, it's also doing this in partnership with our United Kingdom brothers here. So right now we have a common missile department program that is joint between the United States and the UK. So we will have 16 missiles in our version of the ship, and 12 on the UK version of the ship, but essentially the same inboard weapon system, and it'll host the same D5 LE weapon systems going in the future. So that's where we are today. If you look around, last time I was here talking at this summit, you still couldn't necessarily see a submarine being built. There's a lot of structure, a lot of hull frames and those kind of things. I'll tell you, if you walk around Electric Boat, you know, at the Quonset Point facility, where they're building 78% of the ship, between Electric Boat, Quonset Point, Electric Boat, Groton, the rest of the other 22% of the ship is being built down at Newport News. Similar to how we've done construction modularly on the Virginia class, how we do that work breakdown split there. But you walk around both of those facilities, Quonset Point, Newport News, you see a submarine being built. We've gone very much from, just that steel fab to the point where we're getting into horizontal outfitting and vertical outfitting, and actually rolling in the ship's position and conducting horizontal outfitting on sections in both places right now. We're starting to butt up some of the modules together, so they start to form the shape of the ship. We're starting to, you know, build out the internal components that will slide into those modules. You can walk around the modules and understand what kind of part of the ship you're in. Not too long ago, I walked through the CO stateroom just to say that I was there first. I'll tell the CO that someday on that ship that I was the first military officer in that one. But again, good just passes the eye test. And frankly, we're about 30% into construction. So continuing to the target we have to meet is 84-month contract delivery. That means in FY28 we have to deliver that lead ship. And that lead ship has to go through lead ship testing, sea trials and weapons testing, acoustic testing, and other things that we do to bring a lead ship online. It has to be on patrol in FY31, which just happens to dovetail with how I'm bringing Ohio's offline, right? So now I am essentially heel to toe with the Ohio-class submarines going offline, with Columbia-class submarines coming online. In addition to the lead ship, District of Columbia, we also started advanced construction on the second ship in the class, the 827. That will be in the USS Wisconsin. So we're well underway in advanced construction with that. That full rate production will start with that once authorized and appropriated by the Hill. That will start in FY24. Beyond that, two ships are both under contract. Beyond that, we will start the next contract we will award prior to FY26, where we will start serial production of that class and authorize appropriating one ship per year and deliver one ship per year in the 30s until the class is delivered. Right now, the program of record remains at least 12 submarines. Current program of record is 12 submarines in that class. The Nuclear Posture Review validated that that's really at least 12. We'll continue to evaluate that going forward. Decision point for that is not required until the late 20s for me as far as planning goes. So we'll continue to monitor what's going on in the world, how things are proceeding, how the class is proceeding, and make that decision at the end, towards the end of the decade where we need to go more than 12 Columbia class submarines. The other part of what I want to focus on here though is not just the shipbuilding part of this that's going on right now, because we are on track to deliver those ships. We're going to keep pressing that. But there's risks, as we all know. And I haven't made it to all of the speakers today, but I imagine I heard at least in the last discussion, you know, the topic of workforce comes up. And I imagine that comes up frequently throughout all of what we're doing right now. And that really is our challenge right now, is the workforce that I need to deliver these ships. And it's not just at the prime shipbuilders, Electric Boat, Newport News. It's across the 17,000 suppliers we have in the supply base right now. You know, in about 48 states or so where we have manufacturing, where all the pieces parts that have to go feed the shipbuilding that we're doing at private shipbuilder yards. So a lot of, but in the past, we very much left that to industry to drive that. Hey, industry, you need to get to the workforce. You need to manage your supply base. You need to figure out how to go do this. Here's the contract. We realized that that's probably not going to get us where we need to go. And so we've taken much more of a whole of government, whole of industry approach to developing the industrial base and the shipbuilders and beyond the shipbuilders as a collaborative effort here. And we definitely have skin in the game to do that. The key things that we have, as we look at that, as I talked about, it starts with the workforce. Our estimates, part of what we did is this analysis was we brought that analytics to bear to understand, hey, do we really understand the demand signal at the tier 3, 4, 5 suppliers? And are we ready to meet that? And, so we take a very deep look at how we go do that with the lower tier suppliers, where the vulnerabilities are or are not, and how I bolster that, how I mitigate that, what are my other options to do that. That analysis right now shows us that in the submarine industrial base only, we need about 80 to 100,000 workers over the next 10 years, right? If I account for normal attrition, retirements, how demographics are flowing. So roughly we're talking 10,000 people a year we need to induct into the submarine industrial base to be able to go build the 1 Columbia per year of serial production and 2 Virginias per year, Virginia class attack submarines that we need as well. That's what it's gonna take to meet that target. Meet that necessity is a better word than a target. That is a necessity for our nation right now. So how are we gonna do that? So first of all, like I said, I started talking about workforce. It really is a couple of different lines of effort there that we're driving. One of those is how do we think about a national training center, if you will. And so what we've done is partnered with Commonwealth of Virginia, with OSD Industrial Base Analysis and Sustainment, IBAS, right, to start driving some of these training pipeline capabilities to the industrial base. A rising tide that lifts all boats by producing skilled trades. We're starting to mature that in Danville, Virginia, and accelerating training in defensive manufacturing, where we can bring, essentially targeted adult learners, where I can bring in somebody who wants to upskill what they're doing, they want to stop working at Taco Bell and start building submarines, they want to come from other areas throughout the country and try something different. If they're transitioning service members looking for still a way to serve their country and still make a family-sustaining, have a family-sustaining job, that's what that's targeted at. We started with about a pile of about 25 folks. We ramped up to 50, 75 and above now. By FY25, we will have the capability and capacity to produce 800 to 1,000 skilled workers out of there in welding, machining, metrology, non-destructive testing, and additive manufacturing. All skill sets that we think are critical to the industrial base. We continue to evaluate that and look for other opportunities. We need to bring other things to bear in there, like electricians, those kind of things, or what other opportunities might be there. So that's the National Training Center concept where I can go pool from other things, bring everybody together, and then farm them out to wherever we need to go, the industrial base. And there's a relatively mature program down there to do that right now where I'm looking across the industrial base. I have some, I'm a dinosaur kind of guy, I'm not an IT kind of guy, but something that scrapes job websites and then consolidates them down in Danville so that the workforce that's going through that training pipeline understands where the jobs are, and they can apply for those jobs and get hired right out of the gate and disperse that nationally where we need to go. Some of that workforce development is bolstering existing training pipelines. So you think like where I have my strong pipeline under Sunedia and out of Tidewater, so New England and the Hampton Roads area. And what do I need to do to invest in the training pipelines to allow us to better recruit, attract, train, and retain the workforce Some of that is, you know, associated directly with industry. In some places, the pipelines are very mature, but not full enough. In some places, the pipelines are less mature, and they have people go through them. Another line of effort there is kind of, is sometimes just establishing the connective tissue that we broke during the peace dividend. If I look back to the 1980s, the last time I was building one ballistic missile submarine and a couple of fast attack submarines a year, Ohio and Los Angeles class, did the Reagan buildup years. At that time, our industrial base, America in general, was about 32-33% manufacturing jobs. Right now, it's about 11-12%. So not only in the defense industrial base, but our manufacturing base in general has atrophied during that time. And so it's very much of a drive to how do we rebuild that industrial base. And with that atrophying, right, came some of the things that existed back in the 80s, where I had vocational technical schools, and I had career technical education facilities that were connected with industry to be able to go say, hey, the industry has, hey, I need welders, I need machinists. How's your pipeline for getting these in, coming out of the high school level, right, to try to drive them into the business. And so again, that is atrophied as well. And so one of the things we're doing, we started a pilot in Philadelphia, we go Birds, but expanded it up to York, Lehigh Valley, out to Pittsburgh, and we're looking to expand that. New York, Great Lakes region, California, other places where we have key concentrations of critical suppliers, to be able to just connect those tissues, right? Where I have, hey, I have industry saying, I need X amount of jobs filled, and the schools can say, well, okay, we'll draw students to go do that. And that becomes a self-fulfilling thing, because if the demand signal is there, our expectation is that the supply will rise to fill it, and will help me in the, you know, and continuation of that is, once I have those young men and women who have graduated from those pipelines, gone to work, and they now drive their brand new F-150 back to their old schoolmates, and they say, holy cow, I could have a family-sustaining job and go do this, you know, leave my work at work, and support, you know, how support the nation in my own way. We've seen very good results from that. I think I saw Admiral Fritz Rohde here. He benefited. There you are, sir. How you doing? You know, he was part of that Philadelphia pipeline, his company. I think they did pretty well on the draw on that. I think it was a couple hundred folks you might have been done with it, sir. But very good examples of just connecting that reconnected tissue, that, and then it kind of helps sustain itself going forward. In addition to the workforce, the other, I talked about the data analytics to try to figure out where the demographics are, how they're flowing, what we're doing. It's also about where have we not looked before. I'm talking about opportunity workforce. Think about displaced Afghan allies. Think about displaced Ukrainians. Think about other legal immigrants into the country. How do we get into those, the demographics, and make it interesting to them? We've been very successful in reaching out with other, across other government agencies to go do that, to the point that we've actually drawn Afghan allies to the Bengal region. We have placed three of those Afghan trainees actually into the workforce. In not at the prime shipyard buildings right now, but into some of our other tier suppliers. And we now have cadres trying to bring more of those in right now. So where are those other opportunities that I have? And does that provide something like a path to citizenship or something that we can work across whole of government to go provide additional motivation and incentive to go do that? But it's not just the people, right? The other thing that I'm focusing on and my team is focusing on is driving for how do I make technology make the workforce that I have and the workforce of the future more effective at the work that they do, right? So think about, you know, some key things that we're looking at here. Some of that is how is the technology associated with training, that's one thing, but things like metallic additive manufacturing. And what can I do in metallic additive manufacturing to displace the constrained castings and forgings market? How do I bring, you know, cooperative robotics or automated welding to the sea to go through that? How can I, what other technologies exist in the NDT world that can speed things up? Phased array UT instead of radiography. Right? What kind of things can I save time on in the shipbuilding process to buy back schedule, do all the things I need to do to deliver the ships that the nation needs? So that's really the focus. Now, again, the other part of that is there always is some capacity expansion, so we're also working with the shipbuilders about where the constrained markets are, what sort of capital investments are required, either at the prime or throughout the industrial base, where are those key nodes that we can make targeted investments to go both of those parts. And if I can't get the workforce at the shipbuilders, and where else am I going to go? Another strategy has been outsourcing that material. Things that have been traditionally done by the shipbuilders at Electrical Newport News. What other capability exists in the industrial base where the workforce is there and the capability is there to go do that? So we've started outsourcing some partners where I'm building significant portions of the ship that will ship back to the private shipbuilders. Big Austal on the Gulf Coast, there's a shipbuilder that now has a steel line. Grew up in aluminum, but now has a steel line based on investments, and will be supporting the submarine shipbuilding programs. W International, South Carolina, Rhodes Industries in Philadelphia. Okay, some of our focus factory partners that we're talking with right now to do some of that big shipbuilding outside. It's a challenge, that's where the risk lies. But we understand where the risks are, and we are going after those hard. We understand what we're doing. We're starting to see momentum really building on these things. And so when you leave this room, if you have any questions, buildsubmarines.com. Go check out that website, buildsubmarines.com. You can find out more. And we're helping, you know, we're trying to drive, doing some targeted advertising to get people to look at that. Seeing very good results from that to inform the next generation of shipbuilders. And the next generation of manufacturing folks, buildsubmarines.com. Go check it out. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Apple. Now we'll hear from Brigadier General Ty Newman.
All right, well, good afternoon, everybody. Brigadier General Ty Newman. First, I just want to start off by saying thanks to both Jeff and Dave for inviting me to come. I'll be part of this illustrious crowd of experts in the nuclear enterprise. What Jeff didn't mention in my reading in my bio coming into this is, I've had a few jobs, but when you start breaking that down, if you happen to be counting the number of jobs, I've actually had 5 jobs in the enterprise within the last 5 years. So what that goes to tell you, I can't hold a job. So for all those people that are losing jobs, I'm losing them just as fast as I'm gaining them. But part of that is I've had a great opportunity to see the entire enterprise. So 5 years ago, 2018, I was an operational wing commander of D-52, so a nuclear wing. A year after that, I went and spent time under the wing of General Hyten at the U.S. STRATCOM, working at the STRATCOM level. After that, I went to spend a year over at the Department of Energy working in defense programs in NSA. And then I spent the last 2 years in the National Security Council, and now I'm back in the Air Force, I think. So I've had a chance to really see all the way from the ops, all the way to the top of the White House, and back to the Air Staff, where I'm actually working Air Force Future Concepts. And what a great place for a nuclear guy to be, right? To start thinking about the future, and how does the nuclear deterrent play a role in the future? And what I'm finding is there's a lot of opportunity for us out there, and we have to get after it. So that's where I'm going to start with respect to that. I also realize that we are the last panel of that day. And you're only here probably for 2 reasons. 1, because your boss told you had to be here till the end. Or 2, you're waiting for us to tell you something that's going to be earth-shattering that you can go hit the headlines tomorrow with. And I don't know which one you're here for, but I hate to break it to you. I probably not going to tell you anything earth-shattering that you haven't really heard this week. Because there's been some fantastic folks sitting on the stage all week long that are way smarter than I am and have been around this business a lot longer. And I can explain how a nuclear warhead actually works, and I can't. I can tell you where the pointy end of the weapon is, but in the business end, but I can't tell you how that thing is all put together. So with that being said, I'm going to try to cover the best that I can as far as where we are from an Air Force perspective, recognizing the fact that I'm not in the program's office right now, but because I'm a nuclear guy by trade, I stay pretty well tied to this. So if you actually need, no kidding, true data from today, best thing would be to go to our nuclear programs office and our PEOs, and they will help you out with that data. But I'll do the best I can as far as capturing some of that. The other part is, I know it is the last part of the day, so I'm gonna ask you guys to be interactive with me here in a second. So pull out your phone, set them on a table, and I'm gonna ask you to do something with your phone here in just a second. All right, bottom line up front. First and foremost, the Air Force recognizes that the National Security Strategy, the National Defense Strategy, the NPR embedded in it, like we talked about earlier, has placed great emphasis on the fact that we need to divest legacy capability and legacy systems that are no longer relevant in today's fight. And we have to get after the modernization and getting weapon systems and capabilities to the war, in the warfighter's hands that are relevant for today and far into the future. So that's first and foremost. Second, we are fully in line with the NDS when it comes to defending the homeland, deterring against strategic attack, deterring aggression, and making sure that we prevail in conflict. And those should sound very familiar because they also are in line where the NPR is actually in line with the NDS, as you would expect. The Air Force is also fully funding the two legs that we own, plus the 75% of the nuclear command and control NC3 system that we own within the Air Force. Right now, our current air leg, our current land leg, and the NC3 system are well past their design service life. So we're talking 30, 40, and 50 years past the design, not including the service life that are already lived, but past the actual design period of time. And that is absolutely crazy. So this is where I want you to pull out your phone. Everybody pull out your phone. I want you to do two things with your phone. First, turn the camera on. Come on, pull it out. Turn the camera on. Take a selfie to prove that you were here. Second, take a picture of me up here, because it's the first time that I've been on the stage. It could be my last, so we want to make sure we got it recorded. Yeah. And then I want you to raise your hand if you have a phone in your hand that's older than 2 years. Okay, I'm going to do the same because mine's older than 2 years. All right, so anybody have a phone older than 5 years in their hand? Awesome. All right, we still have it. Anybody have a phone older than 10 years in their hand? Okay, go ahead and put them down after you get pictures and stuff. And then we can take pictures later, too. The reason I bring that up, why do you have a new phone in your hand? Why does everybody in this room have a new phone in their hand? Why didn't the phone that you had 10 years ago work? Why doesn't it work today? You need it just for communication, right? You just want to talk to somebody. You want to just, our phone from 10 years ago was able to do the digital stuff that we asked it to do, right? Why doesn't that work today? It's because the environment of our communication and the environment that we're living in has changed so fast that a phone from 10 years ago absolutely cannot meet today's requirements, right? The signposts out here tell us what street we're on. Those are historical markers. Now, nobody actually knows what street you're actually on because they just plug it in your phone and the phone takes you exactly where you need to go. Things are changing. The same thing is applied to our nuclear weapons and our nuclear deterrent. We cannot keep modernizing an old phone because the software is just not there. The battery life dies out. The chips die out. The cases, no longer work. The screen breaks. You know, how many times you try to turn the thing on, it's just it. You just got to throw it out and get it. Put that in perspective from a cop perspective. This is a very steamy crowd. I don't want to guess, but you guys can guess what my salary is, or we'll look it up. I'm guessing everybody in here, the average range of a salary in here is somewhere between $150 and $200,000. How much does a new iPhone cost you? $1,100, $1,200, right? How much is that of your monthly salary? That's about 7%. 7%. Does anybody know what the modernization effort of the entire nuclear enterprise is in the Department of Defense budget? The peak is going to be roughly 7%. All right. So, to put this stuff in perspective, we have to get after this. And this is not just the Air Force capability. It's the same thing the Admiral talked about. We got to get the submarines. We got to get all the NSA warheads and stuff in line. And we have to get after this. It's not a matter of money. It's a matter of will. And then it's a matter of getting our weight and effort, our nation's weight and effort behind getting after some of the problems that we've been hearing about over the course of the last couple of days. So we know that our adversaries have taken a different approach, right? Adversaries have looked at nuclear weapons and found that they are very effective. They can produce them and the effects of their weapons much faster than they can with conventional capabilities. And certainly they can't go up against the United States when it comes to a conventional fight. It's just too costly and it costs them too much. So they're going in a different direction, much different than the United States. A quote from the former STRATCOM commander, Admiral Richard, in his testimony last spring. The strategic security environment is now a three-party nuclear peer reality where the PRC and Russia are stressed and undermining international law, rules-based order, and norms in every domain. Never before has this nation simultaneously faced two nuclear-capable near peers, and we must deter differently. So I ask you, what are we doing differently to deter these adversaries? Because it doesn't seem to be slowing them down at this point in time, so we've got to start thinking differently. Our nuclear peer competitors are aggressively advancing their own weapons. Russia's been developing non-strategic nuclear weapons in and around what the New START requirements are, and they're well over 80% complete with their entire modernization of their force. PRC is pursuing a triad of their own. We heard earlier in the week, the recent DoD China report, 2022, they indicated they could have 1,500 warheads by 2035. As a matter of fact, in open transparency, PRC actually released the number of warheads they're going to have in 2035. Anybody read that this week? How many are they going to have?
They said 900. Wow, that's great.
Who believes it? Nobody. 900, come on, give me a break. They have half that many silos already built in the ground. Do we really believe that they're only going to build 900? There's no way. So Intel reports that it's going to be 1,500, and I honestly believe that they're going to be well beyond 1,500 by 2035 at the rate that they're currently going. Just recently, too, General Cotton, the current U.S. STRATCOM commander, released a statement that the number of silos in the ground now is far exceeded, or has at least exceeded, maybe not far exceeded, but it has exceeded those of the United States. So do we think that they built those holes just to leave them empty? Absolutely not. They plan on filling every one of those holes. So what does that mean from a land-based leg perspective? It means that they will exceed the United States' capability and our plan to fill and update the SCBM leg. So time is not on our side. We started a modernization effort a little over 10 years ago. Well, about 10 years ago, so about 2013-2014 timeframe. The Obama administration, when they recognize the fact that we have to get after this and develop a modernization plan. From that point in time, every administration, every congressional, House, Senate, appropriators, everybody have supported that plan. It has not been deviated. There's been some changes here on the margin. We talked about a little bit what the NPRs have done between 2018 and 2022. We've made some small adjustments here and there, but bottom line, we're getting after it. We're still modernizing. And now the rubber's meeting the road because the bills are coming due, and we've got to start paying those bills. And so I want to continue to support and encourage everyone to continue to support that. And I know most of you here are all 100% in favor of that. The evolution of warfare has certainly changed, and so we need to change with that. I've already talked about all the stuff that the adversaries are doing. And so what I want to do now is turn towards the things that we can actually affect, right? So we can't necessarily change the way our adversaries are going to go after nuclear weapons and their capabilities. But what are the things that we can do to start modernizing? And I like to break it down into two the threats that I'm most concerned about that I can actually affect. And I like to put it into 3M. I call it the 3M model, right? 3M. And you've heard about it all week long, but I use 3M so everybody can remember. Manpower, materials, and money. Those are all things that everybody in this room and every organization in this room can control. So let's talk about this just for a second. So manpower. From a service perspective, and you heard the Admiral talk about it as well, we can control our manpower inside of our services. But as we look at our modernization efforts and what we're doing, particularly in the Air Force, and I'll give you a list of the stuff that we're going to be modernizing here in a second, we have to maintain antiquated legacy systems to support the current requirements of the combatant commander and the nation while bringing on brand new systems and replacing those with zero to no degradation in our ability to deter our adversaries. Okay, so how do I do that? In the bomber force, for instance, or let's take the missile air force, for instance. I have Minuteman III crews that are trained on the Minuteman III, a system that was put in the ground in 1970. With 1970s computer technology, the best that we could actually provide in 1970 in the whole. They are trained to operate that. They're trained to maintain that every day. They're doing a fantastic job, right? 24/7, 365. In 10 years, I'm going to ask those crews to start learning how to manage and fly the Sentinel. Take care of the Sentinel, right? We start putting those in. Where do I get the extra crews to do that? Right? I don't just take a Minuteman III crew one day and then go plug them in a Sentinel silo the next day. There is a training period involved there. These are completely different systems. And it's not like just driving one car and going and jumping and driving the other car. They are completely different systems. You're going to completely different consoles. The communication is going to be completely different. The diagnostics, the way you operate, the way you maintain, all that stuff is going to be completely different. The same things with our airplanes. We have 3 bombers right now. We're going to bring out the B-21. At some point in time, we may have 4 bombers flying. Where do those crews come from? The Air Force does not have a manpower plan to, you know, just dump a bunch of bomber pilots in when the B-21 starts to blow up. We have to figure out a way inside of the Air Force Global Strike Command to manage the crew force so that we can basically fly 4 bombers. And, you know, as we divest the B-2 and the B-1 over time and bring down the B-21, we have to train crews that were flying those older legacy airplanes and teach them how to fly the airplanes. So that happens across the board. It's your maintainers, it's your operators, it's literally everybody, that's the folks in the command post, all of those type of things. That is a huge deal. Then, the second aspect of the manpower piece that I just want to touch on, and most of you are well aware of this, how do I build all of the infrastructure and all of the capabilities and stuff that are going to go into this? The Sentinel program in itself, right after it replaced 450 silos. I have to do one silo on average, one silo per week for 9 straight years. There's some estimates out there that at each of the different ICBM bases, it could take anywhere between a 5,000 to 10,000 person man camp in order to manage it. It's not like we're just building all of these facilities within a couple block area like Amazon's doing here in Crystal City. These places are scattered hundreds and hundreds of miles around my home state of Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and North Dakota. This is a monumental task. It's going to take construction workers that we probably haven't assembled and put together since we built these things in the 1950s and 1960s. Materials. Everybody in here that works in the production facility and stuff understands the limitation on materials. You know, it's anywhere from the computer chips to electronics to concrete, rebar, reinforced steel. All this stuff that's going to go into this modern tank structure and technology stuff is going to need materials as well. And we're going to have to figure out how to get it to location on time so that the folks that are doing the construction can actually get it done. And then money. Who's worried about money? Well, guess what? We are. Because inflation hits us just as hard as it hits everybody else's pocket. Right? And whether stuff is being delivered on time, inflation is going to continue to impact every aspect of it. And if the inflation being felt at the very lowest level is additive over time to the guy that's the bill payer, i.e. the federal government, or in our case the Air Force, is having to pay that, we have to go back to Congress every time and say, hey, we need more money for this program. Sorry, costs are going up. Don't know what to tell you. That's if everything works perfectly, right? And we know that there's going to be some hiccups along the way. So money is going to be a big deal for us. At some point in time, we're going to have to start thinking about maybe how we budget differently for these strategic systems, because it takes so long, it takes a lot of money, and we have to recognize the fact that we're not going to get it right on the very first opportunity. All right, I know I'm running a little bit long here, so I want to get to some of your questions, but I will throw out there, we're absolutely impacted by the pandemic and COVID. When you have COVID hit one of the plants that's critical to us, obviously things are going to slow down. The same thing happens at the workforce. We have to change our shifts around and everything else. That's going to be a huge factor. And then, you know, I mentioned New START previously. We still have to operate under New START and our treaty obligations with our partners, Alex, bottom line. It's one of those things, for me, I would love to just take the handcuffs off of all of you that have great minds and want to do great things in this community and say, go develop. Be innovative. You can't be innovative if I handcuff you and give you a blueprint that says, hey, be really innovative, but here's the blueprint, don't deviate, and oh, by the way, stick to all these safety standards. Where's the innovation? I need you to be able to innovate and come to me with solutions so that we can do that. And sometimes we get tied up and wrapped up in some of our policies with respect to that. All right, so I'm going to run down a whole litany of things that we're working on in the Air Force. I'm not going to cover all these topics, but I'm going to run down through this real quick. B-21, where's my Northrop team? I know you guys are in here, or they were here, but fantastic job in December. Man, give them a round of applause. The B-21, man, I hope every the B-21 on our wall when they leave their open head in mouth, sign whatever you guys want to do. That is a fantastic machine. What a great rollout in December. We've been waiting for that. The world's been waiting for that. We should, everybody in this room should be excited about the fact that we have a brand new capability that everybody can now see. Can't get our hands on it yet, but we'll see it. We'll see it soon. It's going to start flying here soon. It's exciting. It's an exciting time for the nuclear deterrent. And I can't wait, to be honest with you, to see the Columbia start coming out as well and get our Sentinel out. Man, we're going to have a brand new, spanky, shiny triad here soon, and it's a really exciting time. B-52 modernization is going on. The Sentinel, the ICBM. We have the MH-139, long-range standoff missile. The B-61, I know we've talked about that from an NSA perspective, Mark 21A, W87-1. The Survival Airborne Operations Center, in the entirety of the NC3 systems, our weapon generation facilities, and literally all of the supporting infrastructure that supports every one of those programs. That's all we're doing, okay? That's all. I mean, just think about that. So we're doing that from a service level perspective. So this is clearly a massive undertaking that's going to require continued support from our folks down at the end of the street here from Congress. And absolutely, we need to have sustained funding and support from everyone. All right. So with that, I think one of the things that I'll just kind of lump all of these new modernization efforts into just a few things. We're modernizing systems that we've effectively had in the past. These are brand new systems. We're doing it with the best manufacturing technology stuff that we actually have available to us today. There's no way that system, even if we built it off the exact same blueprint, it would not be better because the way we do production and manufacturing today. So these systems are going to be absolutely fantastic. We're going to continue to do that. We're gaining huge efficiencies in maintenance. Fuel efficiency, fuel costs with our SERP program we're doing with the B-52. All these capabilities are coming together and we're making a much better system that's hopefully a better and more cost effective for the United States Air Force and for our nation. So with that, I'll just have a couple of closing remarks, then we'll go to questions. I know we'll leave some time for Jeff and Dave to ask us some questions off the cuff, and we can go into a lot of different detail. As you can tell, I get pretty excited about this stuff, and I can talk for a long, long time on this. We're making great progress, bottom line, and it's because of all of you. There's some great minds in this room. I want to see the next time, if I ever get back actually. The next time we do this, we have 500 people here, I think what was registered. I want to see 5,000 next time. We've got to continue the dialogue outside of this room. We can't just talk to each other about how cool this work we're doing. We actually got to get more people in here to think differently and bring new ideas and actually have a conversation that drives us into the future, because our future actually absolutely needs it. I'm very, very excited as I work throughout the enterprise about the amount of young professionals that are excited about this. It is really, really inspiring for me to see all those young people in there. So what I challenge all of you that are in the business in all these different areas, how do we keep them excited? How do we keep them coming in? And let's lift the barriers on getting them into our organizations. And let's take advantage of that and continue the excitement across the board. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Jeff and Dave here to start asking us a few more questions. And then happy to stick around a little bit later, too, if we run out of time. So with that, thanks.
Thank you, Admiral Capano. Thank you, General Lubin. When we hear from you and some of your colleagues, I'm trying to determine, am I going to sleep well that night, or am I going to be up all night worried? And I'll say generally, I think I'm going to sleep pretty well tonight, but with a couple questions I'd like to ask, and then we have a lot of questions from the audience as well, so I'm glad to see those. Let me start, and we'll also have a microphone available if anyone wants to ask a question directly. Admiral, you talked about the MPR nuanced, that it says at least 12 Columbia-class submarines. General, you were talking about the fact that we have two peer adversaries now with Russia and China. And what I'd like to hear just a little further from each of you is, as we're modernizing, and it's
sounds fantastic, and I love the enthusiasm, and rightfully placed. But are we really building this modernized system? Is it replacing the old one with, for one pair? Are we really thinking about that two-peer adversary with regards to modernization?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Well, the two-peer nuclear adversary conversation is relatively new, right? So we recognize this, we've seen China build, but we did not realize how aggressive they were going to be in that. So I think if you were to ask me if we would go back 10 years and look at our modernization strategy and would we do it differently, I would say yes, we would probably take some different approaches. I think we would put a little more urgency in the work that we're doing to get after this. At the end of the day, we can't spend 15 or 20 years developing a new system or new capability or modernizing and think that we can keep up with our adversaries. And so we have to do things faster, right? It's been kind of a theme here as well. You know, speed is life in this business. And from a military perspective, we focus on our adversary. When we look at our adversary, we do not want to be challenged into a close football game. Sorry, I didn't mean to bring that back up. But we don't want this conflict to go down to the last second of the game.
And we don't want the refs to decide it either.
I mean, we want to dominate from the very beginning of the game. I mean, we don't want to go to the end. And so how do we do that? We have to have capabilities that are overwhelming and deter the adversary from ever taking the next step and thinking that they can take on the United States challenges and win. That would be true. So, absolutely. Well, we're looking at it, we're working on it, and I think the modern system would be
good. Emily, you want to add anything?
On the CBA side, I am not a policy guy. I am not a targeting player or anything like that. So, but there is obviously some shift as we go from the Ohio to the Columbia class. I think that shift is mitigated somewhat by the fact that we will carry through the same strategic weapon system on the platform under Admiral Wolf and Strategic Systems Program. And as we modernize the strategic weapon system, D5LE and D5LE2, that will be also hosted on both the Ohio and Columbia platforms until they go out of service. But there are some thoughts here. I think that's why you're seeing, my view is that that's why you see the nuclear posture review words say what they do, because I am going from 24 tubes on Ohio to 16 tubes on the Columbia, and so how does that factor into the planning equations? Again, I will build as many as STRATCOM and the Navy tells me they need me to build.
Thank you. Well, I think you brought up, Admiral, the number, I want to just clarify, 80,000 new workforce that is going to be
8,100,000 people is what our numbers are showing.
So
over 10 years.
It feels daunting, and yet I've watched you be successful with this in recent years, so we're going to have to keep being very successful. As we've hosted different discussions with our return center, the discussions here, workforce comes up in virtually every, and it certainly for the last 3 years and before that, it's brought up over and over. Oftentimes it's brought up and identified, and I just want to give each of you a little more time when we're thinking about the fact that not only is the Navy and suppliers have to bring on the numbers that Air Force will with all the modernization there and NSA and their modernization and beyond strategic nuclear deterrence modernization, it's enormous. How are we going to all do this? We're all competing. We're all taking each other's workers, and as soon as you get them trained up, they're going to jump over and work somewhere else. What's going to be this? What do you see? Do you see a nationwide approach to how we're going to deal with this workforce shortage?
From my perspective, there has to be this cultural shift. The cultural shift is hard. Right? The bottom line is, for years, me included, I'm guilty. Tell your kids to be successful, you gotta go to college. That's not necessarily true anymore. It probably wasn't even true while my kids were growing up, right? If I look about the opportunities for, and again, I need engineers, I need that as well. So I don't want to downplay the need to generate engineers to support our industrial bases. But what we have lacked is that cultural acceptance of really drive that skill drains is supports a family sustaining job, is a good way of life, supports the nation. And so much of what we're doing going after that is to try to rebuild some of that culture across multiple levels of government. And I think you've seen very strong support, you know, across the administration, across the department, and across the Congress that supports that those kind of initiatives to go do that. And what we've done, I think, is a rising tide that helps lift all boats, I think I said. As we reinvigorate the American manufacturing workforce at whatever level, I don't care whether they go support the bomber program or the club. I care a little bit, but the fact that we generate that workforce to support the defense industrial base, and frankly, American manufacturing writ large, to go, that is part, my view, part of integrated deterrence. I think a strong manufacturing base and a capable workforce, and what that can bring to bear is as great a deterrent against our adversaries as the military's, our ability to go generate force structure and be able to push that to whatever theater we need to go do is as important as anything else.
Thank you, sir.
Let me just add on real quick. In the military, we learn a lot about leadership and how to take care of people. I tell you what it boils down to, if we provide people valuable work, a good place to come to work, where they feel like they're value added, we will draw the talent where we need to go. If you look across our nuclear enterprise right now, and you see some of the infrastructures and some of the facilities our people are having to work in, what makes them excited about coming to work? I mean, we've got to change that completely. It's a cultural change. I mean, why do people go to Google? It's because they get these brand new fancy buildings, they can wear their pajamas, and they get computers wherever they want, and they have coffee shops and things. You don't see that at Y-12. You don't see that out in the flight line. I mean, and same at the submarine bases and everything else. I mean, we're working and operating very quickly. We've got to change. I mean, that's how we get people to come to work. We've got to provide them opportunities where they can provide value. There's a lot of people who want to work. We've just got to provide that opportunity.
Thank you very much. We're going to come, raise your hand, please. We'll get a microphone to you. I'm first going to jump to the first one that was submitted on the app, and then we'll come to you if you raise your hand, please. We have a question someone sent in that says, we've heard about the adaptability of Sentinel to future requirement. Are there any examples beyond Mervyn and Marvin that you might give to flesh out that concept?
Well, I didn't want to get into a whole lot of details with respect to how we're going to get after some of the challenges and stuff from a threat perspective, but what I'll tell you is the way we're designing all of our weapon systems at this point in time is the modularity and ability to adapt to change. What we realize is a rigid requirement that doesn't have an open architecture in the future is just not sustainable. By the time it's actually delivered, it will be based on the threat environment changes so much. So Sentinel is going to be one of those systems. It's going to have an open architecture. It's going to allow us to have some flexibility in the future. The key to success right now is to maintain a single requirement so that we can actually get systems fielded and then work on modularity and adaptability.
Okay, thank you. Do we have a question? Nancy, we have a question right over here, please. While you're walking to bring the microphone, let me ask you a question. Are the concerns of the Navy's ability to maintain its deterrent patrols with the decreased number of Columbia-class submarines compared to the number of Ohio-class?
No, it's something we've looked at, right? So I think to get everybody on a level playing field here, what Dave's referring to is when we started with 18 Ohio-class submarines, we converted four of those to guided missile submarines and left us with 14 ballistic missile submarines to meet STRATCOM requirements. We will do the same, we meet the same patrol levels with 12 Columbia-class submarines. Right now, per the current program record, what allows us to do that and how we've analyzed it, we're taking a very good deep look at where we need maintenance and when. But the principal factor that allows that is, unlike the Ohio-class, the Columbia is designed with a life of ship core, right, which takes a mid-life refueling requirement out of the life of that ship to buy us extra, so you have to spend less time in the mid-life depot period, which allows 12 submarines to cover the same amount of patrol time as 14 submarines. with that time we bought back. Continue to analyze that, continue to make sure we flush that out, but that's the basis for being able to do that.
Thank you. Have a question right here, please.
Hi, Brian Emerson with Aviation Week. General schedule question, so I thought I'd take the chance. Is the Air Force still targeting first flight test of Sentinel this year? Secretary Kendall has recently raised some concerns about the schedule, but though still within its baseline. Has there been any time impact from the Mark 21 reentry vehicle test anomaly, I guess you'd say, from last summer?
Well, to answer your first question, the first flight test is still on track or still scheduled for this year. We're not going to fly it, obviously, until it's ready to go. And so, without getting into any more detail than that, we would anticipate, yes, the first flight test coming in 2023. With respect to your second question there on the Mark 21 failure, what I'll tell you about the failures is fantastic. I'm glad we're starting to fail. It means we're actually pushing the limit and we're learning something, right? Any failure like that, I guarantee, I'm not in the program office, I guarantee they learn more from that than in a successful flight test. Never happy to see failure, but I am actually happy to see failure in this game. Right? I want to see that happen. I think it's a good sign. Mark 21, it's not my specialty, but as far as I know, it's still on track to support the W-71 delivery for Department 2030.
Any other questions, Dan? I have a question here. Each of you addressed this a little bit, but maybe pull the string a little further. It asks, what opportunities or challenges do you see for international collaboration with our allies in the modernization efforts?
I'll start. I mean, we are actively engaged in that modernization effort with the UK. We have maintained that partnership through the Ohio and the Trident D5LE programs. And so that continues going forward to the point where we have, as I talked about earlier, we have essentially a joint program for the Common Missile Department. So we including where our supply base is, we've leveraged some of the UK supply base to do that. You know, think about missile tube building. We have both domestic and UK suppliers of that. We essentially do all that. We do all the outfitting of those missile tubes at Quonset Point, and then we ship those missile tubes to the UK to build out. They build the hull cylinders, but essentially everything else that goes inside the hull cylinders is common between the Columbia and the Dreadnought class. So very tight partnership. We meet with our international partners frequently, again, as the, on the strategic weapons side of things, that is our only international partner in this spectrum, if you will.
Okay. General on the Air Force side?
Yeah, on the Air Force side, we don't have quite the same type of interaction with the UK and stuff as the Army does. But bottom line, we don't really have other Air Forces out there from an allied partner nation that we're actually sharing or working directly with the exception of the fact that, we do a dual capable aircraft type component, so countries that have a DCA type role, we help certify those aircraft, and then obviously provide them the weapons to do so. But what I will tell you is the Secretary is really, really keen, and as well as the Chief, on integration by design. And that's the thing that we've been really marching forward on all of our program stuff. And as we continue to go forward with new weapon systems, whether they're conventional or nuclear, it's really opening up the books a little bit and letting our allies and partners be part of the design so that that there are opportunities for them to buy into it and be part of the turn.
Okay, great. Raise your hand if you have a question. Question back there, please.
Thank you. Nick Wilson with Inside Defense. This question is for Admiral Pompano. Thank you, sir, for doing this. A couple of weeks ago, the Government Accountability Office made public a previously private report about the Columbia program, raised some issues with more closely monitoring potential risks to schedule. Could you give any detail about what steps the Navy is taking to more closely monitor potential risks? Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, with the, as big a program as the Columbia is, you can imagine we spend a lot of time in the Government Accountability Office, right? And they're, kind of its checks and balances. And we're always willing to learn from what they're willing to tell us.
In this particular case, it's less about the schedule, but how we do schedule risk analysis, if you read the GAO piece there. And I'll give you a little bit of perspective. We're going to try to lean into that and try to use some of the government capabilities to go look at whatever, you know, the data files, the data that we can pass to go analyze it. But fundamentally, that was about driving towards a Monte Carlo type analysis or schedule risk analysis. My perspective of that is it's really hard. If it's hard, we wouldn't do it, but it's really hard to make assumptions for that to drive success in the Monte Carlo. If we were going to do Monte Carlo analysis about best case, most likely schedules, we should have done that in 2013. We didn't do that, right? Where we are right now, we said we have a schedule constraint program. We started in 21. We need to deliver in 84 months. To me, it's much more about managing some of the strategic, but very much at a tactical level. What are the critical paths? What are the controlling paths? How do I drive those? Because the assumption that the Monte Carlo can't pick up is, I'm a DX-rated program in DPAS. I am going to apply whatever I need to deliver this ship on time, right? Even if it's at the sacrifice of other programs, right? That I work closely with the Navy on about trying to mitigate those impacts. But you can't really model that into Monte Carlo, right? If I say, at the very extreme, if I just stop other shipbuilding programs, do I think I can build Columbia on time by bringing all that workforce to bear? Yes, I absolutely can, right? So where am I in that spectrum? How much do I have to do, right? That's the fundamental thing. We have very good understanding of how we model the schedule, what we do with that schedule, how we execute to that schedule. Our teams are very closely linked with Electric Boat Newport News on the analysis of those critical and controlling paths and how we might have to adjust those as things arise. And so that's how we do it. Like I said, all that being said, we are going to go look and see what the GAO said about, hey, is there, what should we extract from that? Is there a way to look out in the future, maybe for follow ships, about how we might do things differently in our manufacturing assembly plans and those kind of things? Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you what, folks, what an amazing return summit. We just wind down. We're down to no time on the clock. I know a couple questions we didn't get to, so please try to save it, perhaps the Admiral and General have a moment to answer your questions if you didn't get them answered. We didn't have time to ask all of them. But thank you, gentlemen. This was an excellent